Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Smith, Judge Cochran, the Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Go ahead and take a seat. Thank you for appearing today. The drive was not necessarily anyone's choice drive, so we appreciate you being here on a timely fashion and making that extra effort to adjust your time clock. Both of you have been here before as far as the appellate court, 15 minutes each as far as your arguments. Pick whichever podium you want. The one in the middle does rise and fall. Indicate who you're speaking on behalf of and your name for recording purposes before you begin your argument. And with that said, I'll have our marshal, Joe Turan, call the first case for consideration.
State of Minnesota versus McRaven, A201571.
When you're ready.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Benjamin Butler. I represent the appellant, Jeffrey McRaven. This case was based on one person, Jonte Neal, a man who claimed that McRaven committed this murder that happened to occur in Mr. Neal's car, parked outside of Mr. Neal's parents' house, and after which Mr. Neal, acting alone, dumped the body. The jury did not have a fair chance to assess Mr. Neal's credibility because the state suppressed favorable evidence of Mr. Neal's pro-prosecution bias and his deceit.
I don't know if that's necessarily your best argument because Mr. Neal, you know, I recall the Q&A when he was on the witness stand, and it sounds like he was just saying, hey, you know, my word's not his, I'm a screw-up, I've had all these offenses, and then the numerous number of offenses were basically him telling the jury, I'm not a good guy. So why is this one offense so important as far as piling on in terms of what he, I don't want to say confessed to, but what he acknowledged.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really important point, Your Honor, because you're right. Mr. Neal sort of painted himself as a truth-telling criminal. Like, he said, I'm a criminal, but I tell the truth. What the jury didn't know, though, is as he was sitting there on the witness stand, Mr. Neal was beholden to the Hennepin County Attorney's Office because he faced a presumptive commit felony offense at the time of his testimony. And he knew that he needed the county attorney's office to think well of him in order to avoid going to prison on this fleeing offense. Now, the state and the post-conviction court say it's a low-level felony offense, and that's true, but for Mr. Neal, it's a prison offense. And that's what ended up happening, of course, is that he did get probation for reasons not related to this case. But as he sat there, he needed the state to think well of him. And so that cuts against this idea that he's some sort of charming rogue who does nothing but tell the truth and let the chips fall where they may. That's not what Mr. Neal was sitting there thinking. And the case is actually pretty similar to an old seminal cross-examination case called Davis versus Alaska. In Davis, the witness was on probation. And so because the witness, who was a criminal, was a juvenile criminal, was on probation, he needed the government at Mr. Davis's trial to think well of him. And so he gave them Mr. Davis. The jury in Davis never knew that. Now, in that case, it was because the judge prohibited cross-examination. In this case, it's because the state suppressed the evidence that would have led to the cross-examination. But the result is the same. The jury is left with the impression that the witness basically has nothing to gain or lose here, and that this was his friend who was murdered, and whatever else is going on in the witness's life, he's going to tell the truth to get, you know, justice for his friend who was murdered. And that is not true. The witness absolutely had something to gain. And that's why Davis talks about bias as the most effective form of impeachment, and specifically differentiates bias from, for example, impeachment by the fact of a prior conviction. Post-conviction judge in this case said, well, he was impeached with his, you know, he had a couple of prior felony convictions and he was impeached with that. And that's true. And the Davis court actually says, well, sure, impeachment by prior conviction is fine, but bias impeachment is much better, for lack of a better word. I'm not quoting exactly, I'm paraphrasing. Better for the questioner, because it goes more directly to the witness's motives.
How do we look at when the district court said that Neal's credibility was vigorously impeached at trial? I mean, that's coming from the court. So
sure.
what do we do with that?
Two answers to that, Your Honor. First of all, your review of this matter is de novo. Your review, and that's specifically to the question of whether this evidence was material. The Minnesota Supreme Court has made clear that specific question, was the suppressed evidence material, is reviewed de novo on appeal. And that case is cited in our brief. So you don't defer to the district court or credit the district court's classification of the evidence. I have three answers. Second, if you look at what the district court said, on page 7 of the district court's order, what she said was that suppressed evidence was not, quote, material enough to undermine confidence in the outcome. Material enough is not a thing. It's either material or it's not. And material is a really low standard. It's less than a preponderance of the evidence. So we don't have to show by 51 or 50.1% that the chances that the outcome would have been different. We just have to show that there's a reasonable possibility, which again, the United States Supreme Court has made clear is less than a preponderance. So with all that in mind, go back to Your Honor's excellent question about the actual cross that happened here. I would encourage the court to read that cross-examination. Because what you will see is the defense attorney, all he does is walk Mr. Neal through the direct testimony. And you testified that this happened, yes. And you testified that that happened, yes. There's no other than the one thing, which is his change of story about how the body got dumped, which had already been put out there by the prosecution. There is no vigorous cross. There's no impeachment by prior inconsistent statement. There's no sort of, you want this jury to believe, ha, ha, ha. There's none of that. All it is walking him through his prior statement. That's it.
May I ask, counsel, does the testimony at the evidentiary hearing from the prosecutors on both this matter and then the matter that was pending that was not disclosed, right?
Yes.
Does any of that matter to the analysis?
At this
point, I understand the obligation to search for and turn over, but how does that factor in?
At this point, it doesn't really, Your Honor, because the post-conviction court, in our mind, correctly found that the state had suppressed the evidence and that the evidence was favorable to the defense. And the state on appeal has not contested those findings. And so the bulk of the post-conviction testimony at the evidentiary hearing went to those two questions. You know, what happened here? What was the evidence? And why wasn't it disclosed? So we've met our burden to show that there was favorable evidence to the defense and that the state suppressed it. So what matters here is whether the evidence was material, which is, again, a relatively low burden, and whether we can show, not even by a preponderance, that it could have mattered. And given the bias evidence, we think it did. Yes, Your Honor.
I'm sorry.
Sure.
But prejudice is a part of a Brady violation analysis, is it not?
Yes, that's
it does not end with materiality. Are you saying those are the same things?
I'm saying they're very similar to the same thing, Your Honor. And in fact, materiality is probably lower than prejudice. And again, if you think they're separate, I'd encourage you to look at Kyles versus Whiteley, because the old 1995 United States Supreme Court case, which lists four important things to know about a Brady violation. Number three or four in that list is there's no separate prejudice inquiry. It's materiality. That's what matters. And so the question is, could this have mattered? There was no other evidence here of Mr. Neal's pro-prosecution bias. In fact, it was the exact opposite. Mr. Neal testified that prosecutors are not his friends and cops are not his friends. because he's a criminal, et cetera, et cetera. And the point of those questioning, that question came from the prosecutor on a redirect of Mr. Neal. And the point of that was to establish what Judge Werke and I were discussing at the very beginning of this argument, which is that Mr. Neal is a screw-up and a criminal, but a truth-teller. And that's just simply not the case, or at least there was plenty of evidence that that wasn't the case that the jury never heard. If the jury heard that evidence and still believed Mr. Neal, well, then fine. But the jury didn't hear it, and the jury didn't hear it because the state suppressed it. And so we think on that basis alone, Mr. McRaven is entitled to a new trial. In the alternative, if the court can't quite get there, and I would really encourage you to, I do want to address the other post-conviction issues. Mr. McRaven presented evidence that Mr. Neal had laughed about helping get an innocent person sent to prison. The quote is, "Now the whole world knows what it's like to, quote, be locked up for some shit you ain't even do." We presented evidence that Mr. Neal had confessed to the murder when he shot another man and said, "I'll do you like I did Ghost," which Ghost is the decedent in this case. There was evidence that was presented to the post-conviction court that Mr. Neal had a motive to want Mr. Ingram dead. In fact, he had two. They were feuding over a woman, and there was rumors that Mr. Ingram had killed Mr. Neal's brother. And then there's all kinds of other sort of assorted stuff, like the testimony or the affidavit from witness Felicia Davis, who would have testified that Mr. Neal was lying when he said on the witness stand that he showed her the decedent's body in his car. The post-conviction court didn't give us a hearing on any of that stuff, and the reason is because it misapplied the burden. The post-conviction court at pages 2, 15, 18, 19, and 20 of its order talked about how the petitioner bears the burden of, and the word the post-conviction court uses is proving. Either proving, sometimes she says proving, sometimes she says establish or establishing. Of establishing the facts.
Did the district court accept the evidence is true in your view in its analysis?
No, we do not think the district court accepted the evidence is true. The district court did not view the evidence in the light most favorable to Mr. McRaven. So she didn't affirmatively reject anything. She didn't say, "I don't find this credible," because she can't do that. But that's only one thing she can't do. The other thing she can't do is not view the evidence in the light most favorable to Mr. McRaven. So for example, the confession evidence, the district court, post-conviction court said, well, that was merely impeachment, would have been merely impeachment. Well, that's not, a confession to committing the crime is not impeachment. That's substantive alternative perpetrator evidence. And remember, in this case, Mr. Neal was the properly noticed alternative perpetrator. The state agreed that the defense had met its burden to show that Mr. Neal was connected to the offense and was the quote-unquote alternative perpetrator. When that happens, evidence that the alternative perpetrator might have committed the crime, like a confession or motive, is specifically referenced in the Supreme Court cases, that's substantive evidence that goes to show that Mr. McRaven is not guilty. That's not impeachment evidence, which is what the post-conviction court called it. The Facebook post, "Now the whole world knows what it's like to be locked up for some shit you ain't even do," and I'm sorry to swear, but that's what the post says.
But I don't consider that a confession.
No, that's not a, yeah. I agree
You're
that's not
talking about the one where he's talking about Ghost.
Yep, there are two, Your Honor. The direct confession is he's shooting a man named Derek Walker, and he says, "I'll do you like I did Ghost." That's what I mean when I say confession. The Facebook post is not a direct confession, but in a way it's almost more troubling because in the light most favorable to Mr. McRaven, which is how this has to be viewed at this stage, it's the state's key witness essentially taunting the world about what he did. This post was made days after the verdict. I can't remember how many days, but it's in the record how many days after the verdict. It's from Mr. Neal's Facebook page. Unless Mr. Neal helped get some other innocent man sent to prison in the month of June, July 2020, he's got to be talking about this case. Or at least it is not so clear that he's not talking about this case so as to deny an evidentiary hearing. And that, I think, is the way the court needs to think about it. We don't have to show at the pleading stage that he's talking about the case, he's talking about lying, he's talking about McRaven. We just have to show that it is not so conclusively clear that he's not, that the district court can deny an evidentiary hearing. And the Nix case from the Minnesota Supreme Court is really, I think, instructive on this point, because that case relates to ineffective assistance of counsel, which we also have claims on that were denied, so it's maybe most directly relevant there. But the Supreme Court in Nix says, look, and Nix is denied an evidentiary hearing. That's the issue, is should he get one? And the Supreme Court says, we don't have to decide whether Mr. Nix's attorney's performance was deficient or not. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. We don't know. We don't have to decide that. All we have to decide is that it might have been deficient. There's a basis to think it might have been deficient. And as a result of that, Mr. Nix gets an evidentiary hearing. And that's why it's reversed and remanded. And the same thing is true here. The post-conviction court wasn't supposed to decide whether petitioner proved or established his case. That's what the hearing is for. The post-conviction court just had to say, sure, there's a claim here. These are the facts to support the claim. Let's have a hearing and we'll see what happens. And then the post-conviction court decides whether we've proven our case by a preponderance of the evidence. And so if the court is not inclined to grant Mr. McRaven a new trial on the Brady issue, which again, given how low the materiality factor is, I would strongly suggest that the court do, at a bare minimum, this case has to be remanded for an evidentiary hearing on the other issues in our petition. And I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Perfect timing. Thank you, Mr. Butler.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. Appellant has raised four counseled claims in this appeal, and appellant has also made a slew of allegations and assertions in his pro se supplemental brief. In an attempt to be helpful to the court this morning, I can answer questions or concerns about any of the individual claims that have been raised.
Thank you for offering that. Let's talk about the video or the Facebook, why people put stuff on there. We'll never know, but explain that to us from your perspective, why he did not and was not entitled to an evidentiary hearing.
I'm going to Judge Cochran's question. I believe Judge Meyer, the district court judge, did assume the allegations and all of the factual assertions were true with respect to the Facebook posts and the video. In terms of the Facebook post, I believe it was just being discussed, that was posted on, I believe, August 18th, 2020, 12 days after the trial, where ultimately Neil, again, according to Facebook, there's a Facebook account. What we have is the Facebook account with his name attached, having something said. So I do think, actually, that Judge Meyer looked at this evidence in the light most favorable to the defense by going to the point of assuming, for the purposes of her analysis, that that post was made by Neil, considering there was no testimony from Neil, no affidavit from Neil, no idea how those words actually got on the internet, on the Facebook profile associated with Neil's name. But going to the actual contents, we don't know what was going on August 18th, 2020. Yes, 2 to 3 weeks beforehand, Neil had been the key witness in the trial against Jeffrey McRaven. But just like a week or two before the trial, when he had committed fleeing from a police officer in a motor vehicle, it is just as likely that there was yet another offense in his detailed criminal history that he actually could have been arrested for and then perhaps sprung out of jail and charges ultimately being dismissed on August 18th or shortly before. In that August 18th Facebook post, he makes no reference whatsoever to this particular case, to Jeffrey McRaven, to any other nicknames associated with it, unlike the other Facebook posts and other social media in which he does reference Jeffrey, for instance. So I don't think that particular post really has any bearing or relevance whatsoever, as newly discovered evidence in this case. Is there another particular post you'd like to discuss, Judge Werke?
Well, the one that Mr. Butler is calling a confession.
I don't view that as a confession. I agree, and I don't think Judge Meyer abused her discretion by viewing that as impeachment. There was a long history between those two individuals, between Mr. Neal and Mr. McRaven, stretching back more than a decade. So it is unclear if that's referring to a murder, a fight, an argument. There's nothing in that particular post that really would establish it is pulling the trigger in the gun in early or mid-January of 2020.
Can you walk me through the record on that statement by him? What is it that's, because part of what I'm hearing on the first one is there was not an affidavit from Neal saying, oh, in my Facebook post, I was referring to McRaven. And you're saying it's, I guess, then doesn't need to be assumed in favor of him, in favor, I guess, of the defendant, that he was. In the confession, can you tell me what the affidavit evidence it was relevant to that statement?
There's definitely no affidavit from Neal with respect to any of these pieces of alleged newly discovered evidence. Mm-hmm. So I believe it was, a video, I think, that was posted on Facebook, or maybe comments that were attributed to a video that somebody saw on Facebook. Definitely not information that came firsthand from Neal. Does that get your question, Judge Smith?
Well, and maybe you don't know, and that's okay. We could look. But I wondered specifically, how did this get before the court? What affidavit was it, and what did the affidavit say about the how I did ghost?
I don't know the answer, unfortunately, to that question right now. I'm sorry. I hope actually Mr. Butler can bring that back up on rebuttal.
Okay.
I believe it is in the record in terms of one of the attachments to that post-conviction petition, but I cannot recall it this time.
Okay.
Can you address, kind of relatedly, Mr. Butler's argument that the post-conviction court applied the wrong standard in determining whether or not to grant an evidentiary hearing at the post-conviction stage?
I believe the standard that Mr. Butler was relying on is the one in the statute, 590.04, I believe. And the standard that I think has been reaffirmed multiple times by our state Supreme Court is the one I cite in my brief coming from, I believe, the sites I chose this time were Robinson and Erickson. And that's that if you assume that the factual allegations that are put in the post-conviction petition or any supporting documentation like affidavits are true, then you can apply the relevant legal test that would need to be applied to see if that was going to change the outcome of the proceeding that is being challenged. So in this particular case, the applicable legal test is the four-step Rainier standard, and that is exactly what Judge Meyer did.
I think he was arguing, and I maybe misheard him, but I thought he was arguing that the district court basically concluded that McRaven didn't prove or establish that he was entitled to a new trial on the claims, but the standard is not exactly that. The standard is, as articulated in case law and under the rules. So can you address that argument?
Sure. I don't want to put words in Mr. Butler's mouth. I don't agree with the characterization, Judge Cochran, you just repeated in terms of how that describes Judge Meyer's detailed 25-page order. I believe multiple times she says, even if these facts do exist, or assuming that these facts exist, she took them, again, as she is obligated to under the law, as being true, and then went to the legal analysis under those four prongs of the Rainier test.
So the statute, which I now have before me, and I had misplaced it when I was asking the question, but the statute provides that unless the petition and files and records of the proceeding conclusively show that petitioner is entitled to no relief, the court must hold an evidentiary hearing.
I would agree with that. That's what the statute says.
And in the order, I think it says that McRaven did not establish that he was entitled to a new trial. So did the district court apply the correct standard in its analysis?
I believe it did. I believe the way those two can be reconciled is I don't think McRaven, assuming the truth of all of the factual allegations, that those would meet the applicable legal standard. Those would not meet the Rainier test. So I believe what Judge Meyer was saying is that, at that point, petitioner and now appellant did not meet the burden that they have to show they were entitled to a new trial based on these alleged facts, because these alleged facts under the applicable legal test, Rainier, would not warrant a new trial.
Thank you.
I want to jump in and touch on the argument that Mr. Butler started with this morning, which was his primary claim in his brief, and how he articulated this morning was that Neil was biased because he was trying to get in the good graces of the trial prosecutors because of this pending fleeing police in a motor vehicle case. I want to emphasize that that is entirely speculative. If that's what Neil was trying to do, and that was the his motivation and his bias in his testimony, he likely would have told that to the attorney who then began representing him on the fleeing a police officer in a motor vehicle case when that case was subsequently charged on August 17th, 2020. As the record made very plain, there was never any discussion whatsoever in that fleeing a police in a motor vehicle prosecution against Neil about what Neil had done, i.e. testify as the key witness in McRaven's trial earlier that year. It was just unknown. It was never conveyed to anyone, either his own attorney, the prosecutor who was responsible for making ultimately the downward dispositional offer in that case, to that prosecutor's supervisor. If Neil was biased by that,
how do we know from the record that there was no discussion with his attorney about it? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
And how do we know that from this record?
I guess we have, what the record does say is that there was no discussion between that Neil's defense attorney and the prosecutor. I guess
that comes from the prosecutor on that case's
correct,
testimony.
Whose name was Katie Anderson. She testified at the first of the two post-conviction evidentiary hearings in this case that Mr. Butler was present for. It's just entirely speculative. Nothing from Neil himself in the form of testimony, in the form of an affidavit, as if that was his motivation. I mean, there's no idea that he even knew that the police were going to be following up and looking for him after that fleeing incident on July 17th, or that the two prosecutors that were involved in this particular case would have had anything to do with that case in terms of Mr. Neil's understanding of the jurisdictional lines or the severity level of offense and which prosecutor's office would even be handling that. The idea of painting Neil as biased because of that fleeing incident is entirely speculative and unsupported by the record.
Can you square the idea that the materiality is measured as with respect to the prosecutor's office as a whole, irrespective of independent individual knowledge? I mean, how can some, I mean, does the state disagree that it's a material non-disclosure?
It was not material. Under the three prongs, the Brady test,
okay.
You have favorability and suppression. I think you actually usually have suppression and favorability in the way that it was organized in the case law. And Judge Meyer found, based on the lead trial prosecutor's testimony at the first post-conviction evidentiary hearing, that those two prongs were satisfied. And then she ultimately concluded that the evidence of this pending or open and yet to be charged fleeing police in a motor vehicle case was not material under that third prong, materiality. And I want to address something because I felt there was a little confusion during the prior argument about what about how material is defined. And if you go to, in my brief, I cite the Thorenson case, which is from our state Supreme Court a little bit less than 2 years ago. It was 2021. And they specifically define materiality as that third prong. And
what page of your brief are you on? 13, 12?
Which I apologize for not having it pulled up. Page 12, yes. So I'm quoting Thorenson there, and you have it in front of you, Judge Cochran, and it defines materiality as, in other words, the absence of evidence that must have caused prejudice to the defendant. This Supreme Court that controls this issue in this state defines materiality by using the word prejudice. We do look at the prejudice when we are looking at that third prong of Brady, and I thought that may have been misstated earlier, so I just want to draw the court's attention to that as how materiality is defined in the context of a Brady claim.
And so in that materiality / prejudice prong is where you can consider whether these prosecutors even knew of, that's what I'm trying to get.
I apologize, Judge Smith. I understand your question better now. That whether the prosecutors knew or doesn't know, ultimately does not matter because of the, I think, imputed knowledge element. I mean, the Hennepin County Attorney's Office is large. Katie Anderson, who was the attorney who ultimately charged Neil with fleeing a police officer in a motor vehicle, this case was sitting uncharged in her internal case management software queue during the trial.
But that doesn't mean it might not have affected how Neil viewed the situation.
That part is true. I guess my response to that, Judge Cochran, is that it was entirely speculative and nothing in the record supports how Neil would have viewed the situation in terms of biasing him, even knowing that, you know, he was going to eventually be charged with fleeing a police officer in a motor vehicle, or that this particular prosecutor's office would have had anything to do with that because of the severity level of the offense, because of where it necessarily happened. It's just entirely speculative. You would need information from Neil to establish that bias claim, which I don't believe bias in and of itself was raised below this court either.
So, and there was an evidentiary hearing on this issue, correct?
Yes, on the Brady issue. And
so is your argument then that the defendant who had the burden of proof at post-conviction, right, did not put any evidence sufficient to establish the materiality and prejudice, could have put in what Neil's understanding was? What is that?
Yes, that would have been an opportunity to call Neil as a witness. For sure. He had been called as witness once before. He could have been subpoenaed again. Ultimately, appellant chose not to do that. To make sure I clarify your question with the half minute I have left, Judge Smith, the suppression prong is the one where I think that your question went to, which is that, you know, another attorney in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office was aware in their, you know, internal case management software queue of this case, but the two prior prosecutors that were involved in this case, really anyone involved in McRaven's trial, had no idea. And Neil, I mean, the record is very clear that Neil never communicated that to anyone, particularly the trial prosecutors, you know, either leading up to or during the trial. I see my time is out. I'm more than happy to answer any additional questions the panel has.
Can I ask one quick clarifying
Certainly.
Question? I think you said bias wasn't raised below during the post-conviction proceeding. Is that correct? I just want to make sure I understood what you were saying.
I feel that the way that Mr. Butler formulated the theory during the argument this morning was not presented in that same way below to the post-conviction court.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Butler, you have the last word.
Thank you. I want to pick up right there, Judge Cochran. Yes, it was. Post-conviction memo, I'm sorry, I don't have the document number in front of me, but the post-hearing memo at pages 8 to 9 makes the bias argument, the exact same bias argument that we are making to this court today. So it was presented to the post-conviction court. I also wanted to just check on materiality. In Kyles versus Whiteley, it's 514 U.S. 419 at page 435, Judge Smith. The United States Supreme Court specifically says that if the evidence is material, there is no need for a harmless error analysis, which means that prejudice, what we generally think of as prejudice, is not really part of this inquiry. And that's the Supreme Court of the United States. Materiality and prejudice are similar, but they're different. They're different standards. And one of the things that makes them different is the qualitative assessment you do of the chances that the suppressed evidence would have could have resulted in a different outcome at the trial. The burden is lower. When the government suppresses evidence that is favorable to the defense, the materiality burden to show that it might have mattered is lower for the defense. And that's probably intentional, because when the government suppresses favorable evidence, that probably really matters. And when the entire case comes down to one witness, Mr. Neil is I can't emphasize this enough, he is the only evidence that Mr. McRaven was even in that car after the trip to the casino. Let alone that Mr. McRaven committed this murder. There is one piece of evidence. There's no forensic evidence. There's no murder weapon. There's no statements from Mr. McRaven. There's no cell phone records. Nothing except Mr. Neil. And so this idea that, oh, well, he was impeached with some other stuff, that doesn't work here. And the United States Supreme Court in cases like Giglio and in other cases cited in our brief explain why that's true. The same is true in Davis versus Alaska. When it's basically a one-witness case, stuff that goes to bias and impeachment and credibility when the government suppresses it really, really matters. And you've got a guy sitting in prison for 390 months for a murder that the other person involved had posted on Facebook then the 5 days after the verdict. Now the whole world knows what it's like to go to prison for something he didn't do. If I were a prosecutor and I saw that post, I'd think, oh no, did I get played here? Now maybe you didn't. Maybe the post is about something else, or maybe Mr. Neal's just popping off, I don't know. But that's your witness taunting everyone, saying he tricked you. That at least gets an evidentiary hearing to figure out what's going on.
Does it matter that there is no affidavit testimony from Neal talking about what he intended by that?
No. I cannot compel Mr. Neal to give me an affidavit about anything. And we were denied an evidentiary hearing on that claim, Your Honor. I couldn't have subpoenaed him.
That's what you're asking for, yes.
That's what I'm asking for now. Mr. Neal's in prison right now for a burglary. If we have an evidentiary hearing, we'll bring him in, and I'll ask him the question, okay? But we couldn't do that because the judge denied an evidentiary hearing on this claim, and I can't compel anyone to give me an affidavit or do anything. I wanted to go back real quick before I'm out of time. Judge Cochran's question about the standard and the difference between the statute and some of the case law articulating the statute. Judge Cochran, the key word there is conclusively. And the Nix Court talks about this a lot. It emphasizes the word conclusively. It is qualitatively different to say what Judge Meyer here said, which is, you can't meet your burden. Yeah, I've considered, you lose. That's a merits ruling. That is qualitatively different than saying, under no set of circumstances could you possibly meet your burden. It is conclusive that you can't meet your burden. That's what the post-conviction statute requires before you can deny a hearing, and that's what the Nix Court explained, and that's why the Nix Court ordered an evidentiary hearing. And finally, just one more record question. I'm happy to answer any other questions, but Judge Smith, you asked about how the confession got in the record, the actual confession, I'll do you like I did Ghost. Our addendum at pages 27 to 28 describes witness statements to our investigator recounting those statements from Mr. Neal. And the Minnesota Supreme Court has been clear that an affidavit from an investigator recounting witness statements is sufficient to at least get a hearing.
So it's just like, two jumps. The investigator an affidavit says that this person told him, I heard this directly from
something along those lines, yes.
Okay.
And again, if we have a hearing, the rules of evidence apply. Maybe we have a hard time with hearsay and some other stuff, but that's about a hearing. Mm-hmm. That we don't need to present admissible evidence to get a hearing. We just need to present evidence, and we did that. I think I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for briefing and appearing today in support of your argument, which is very helpful to us. The matter is deemed submitted, which means a decision will be issued in the statutory time frame of 90 days. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.